Sound check. Test, test, test. Ja. Sound check. Test. Actually works. Hello everyone, welcome to the lecture number 7. It looks like everything is working today, so this is very good. We're going to talk today about unsupervised learning or the cluster analysis, or you know, there are multiple names for these types of methods. We're going to focus on k-means, the method that you can find in Weka. We're going to focus on SOM, self-organizing map. This is a format of, or the type of neural network that is, I think it was designed in 2001 or 2 in Finland by Kohonen. And then it became very popular because it helps to compress the data in terms of using the visualization, like you can compress multidimensional data to two-dimensional data. So this is one. This is one example. Another example, for example, we need to find samples from similar groups or similar classes. So it's often, for example, if we have a set of computer viruses, we want to apply maybe unsupervised learning or clustering to find what are the similarities. Maybe there are some similar, groups. Maybe there are some similar patterns in the data set, you know, something that we want to discover. And it's a natural thing because we don't want to dig through the data self ourselves. Instead, we want to apply some kind of intelligent method. It's almost the end of this course. So for today, the recommendation is to read Kononenka 12 and TO2, the chapter 2, where it will be described the unsupervised learning and cluster analysis. You'll have one more tutorial, and so we don't have any Guest lecture, unfortunately, for 5th of May, but you're welcome to, you know, to send me email, or if you want to sit and discuss something, just feel free to reach out on campus or on Zoom. So it's rather open session where you can practice the exam. I also published the exam from the previous years on the Blackboard, so you can check those as well. So we have two mandatory parts in this course. The assessment parts is four assignments. The deadline is 27th of May this year. And then we have also the exam. It will be on 20th of May. So technically, you need to pass both parts to be able to finalize or to finish the course assessment. I have to mention a few things in the coming slides that are very important for the assignments and for the exams. So it's about the assessment forms and the academic writing. As you know, the coronavirus that came 2 years ago that kind of brought a lot of challenges in the assessments, in the way how we perform the exams. So normally in this subject, you know, through like last 10 years we had in-class assessments. So you had, you've been sitting in the class and you've been answering, using sometimes calculators taking the exam in that format. So for us, it's been a lot of challenges, and you probably remember that it was in December that there had to be a change from the in-class exam to a digital home exam. This semester we have a digital home exam that is 3 hours, so it means that you will be answering this exam in Spera. And for us, it will be important to be able to assess your knowledge of the course material. So they will be rather open texts, or we can say essay-based questions, where you need to demonstrate how to apply machine learning methods. So as I mentioned, there have been a lot of challenges, the challenges that we also seen in December. There have been, sometimes changes between the A to F grading, to pass-fail grading, like how to convert the exam that was like traditionally in-class exam, where you've been sitting, working on the on the task, to exam format where you need to demonstrate, kind of the same level of judgments while sitting at home and technically having access to, all materials, all the lectures and books. So the challenges that I would like to name is the plagiarism. So there are a lot of strict regulations, and there are a lot of, there have been cases where, the students been copy-pasting the answers from the internet or from other sources, and the problem that if you put it in Spera, it will be detected easily. So it's very important that you follow the regulation. You can read a little bit more about cheating in the exam and what is considered to be cheating. So it's usually cases where like a student present a work from somewhere. It means that if somebody copies just a paragraph of text from from the book, from blog posts, from articles, and then, submit it as own work. So everything has to be own, so we expect you to provide your own independent answers in both assignments and as well as exams. So if you have to use, some kind of phrases or explanation from the book, please use quotation marks. And also put the source where it comes from, like citation references. So it's very important to follow the guidelines. There have been a lot of let's say cases where the students were copying or preparing the answers before the exam and then just submitting those answers in the Inspera. And if you have like multiple answers, then it will be easy to detect such cases. So, as I mentioned, we expect you to deliver your own independent work. So normally, if we talk about the assignments, it's technically a free format, but we expect you, to have some kind of explanation, to have some kind of like short text that gives the analysis, maybe why you you obtain these results, why, you know, the accuracy is 30% and not 90%. But technically, you know, it's the structure that you can see, it's the common academic structure. Of course, you can adjust, of course, you can put it. So always try to reference. You can find, you know, sources for the references on the Google Scholar. You can use Grammarly to check, for example, English writing. You can use Microsoft Office to check the English writing, and so on. So it's very important that you deliver your own independent work. Now, the use cases that I also like to mention is the quotations, right? So sometimes students put, let's say, two paragraphs as an answer in the Inspira. And then they move to the next question. So if there are no quotation marks, if there are no, let's say, references or citations, proper citations, then it's considered to be a plagiarism. So it's also very important to understand that if you copy like the whole text, you put the quotation marks and the reference, then still it's not your own independent work. So it's very important that you write yourself, like your understanding of the question. Sometimes the students are using, let's say, the adaptation of the text. I mean, just change the synonyms, you change, you know, a few words here and there. But still, it's possible to find such cases. So it's very important still, I emphasize that you deliver your own independent work. Yes, any questions to this part? So just, you know, it's just information. It's not that we kind of expect that somebody will copy, but like every semester we try to give this information so that the students know how to, you know, how to follow the rules. So if you have any questions or if you have any doubts, you know, how to use the quotations, references, please talk to us, and of course we can help and explain. Right, let me put the next slides. Right, so in this part, there will be two parts of clustering. In this part, we'll talk about hierarchical and partitioning clustering. So there are two types of clustering that normally you can see in the literature, and of course you will see, you know, the explanation in the Kononenko, in other books. But normally it's a hierarchical, so based on the taxonomies. For example, you know, the species in the biology classes, you can see the taxonomy and how they're related, whether it's the same family or not. So it's rather an organizational chart that shows, for example, a CEO in the company, you know, a CTO, CISO, for example, and how they arrange the project managers, the project members. So everything that can be characterized in the organizational format is considered to be hierarchical clustering. So partitioning clustering is a little bit different approach, where technically we take, you know, every data samples in the data set and try to evaluate how close or how similar they are based on the defined parameters that are number of clusters that we want to achieve and also the centroids or the centers of the clusters. As I mentioned, this is unsupervised learning, so it means that we don't need to provide any guidelines to the methods, like in case of classification or supervised learning, but we need some crucial parameters. So usually the first crucial parameter is the number of clusters. It's either in hierarchical clustering or partitioning. And the second one is the location of centroids. So centroids define you know, like the area where we can find a similar group of data samples. So like, for example, you know, when you start, I don't know, the semester, usually in August, you have the Faderuka, where, you know, the kind of, there are clusters. If you look at the football field, there are usually clusters, people like, you know, gathered based on their year, based on their, you know, the studies, specialization, and so on. So this is like a partitioning clustering. Of course, multiple methods, it's not all, but these are the pillars in the clustering algorithms. It's the k-means clustering, Gaussian mixture model, canopy clustering, and vector quantization. Canopy clustering is a very interesting approach that is rather designed for big data applications. So as you know, like most of the methods in machine learning, they've been, you know, designed in the area of small data, like in 80s, 90s, when you know, the computer power wasn't that great, and of course, you know, the data that had been stored on the hard drives could reach like, you know, 0.5 gigabyte or 1 gigabyte. That was considered to be a big data. But now, you know, we have a different scale of big data, like, you know, terabytes, thousands of terabytes, distributed storages, distributed location, cloud computing, and other similar technologies. So canopy clustering is the way to speed up the clustering algorithm, because if you apply the k-means clustering on the large data set, it will be relatively slow, so it will take some time. So that's why canopy clustering is the two stages approach, where first the method tries to find, you know, the preliminary clusters, and then try to assign also all data samples in the particular cluster. So the two main essential functions that are used in the clustering algorithms, this is similarities, natural associations. Like, for example, if we have two data samples, we need to see how close they are. So if they're located very close to each other, then it means that they're similar. So it's usually used distance metric. And how different? So if we have two samples here, and then we have one sample here, then of course, you know, the distance from either of two samples to this one will be quite big. So we have, let's say, two samples, and then we have one sample here. So this distance, this is a similarity distance, will be much smaller than distance between either of those two and the another sample. So this is the notion of similarity and the notion of difference. So based on these distances, we can even without looking at the data, even without looking at the visualization, we can find that, you know, there are samples that are more similar and there are samples that are quite different. So it's usually very, let's say, broad definition of what is considered to be similar, like it can be distance. We're going to talk today about different types of distances. But technically, in all of the clustering methods, we are talking about some kind of similarity or some kind of distance between the samples. So everything depends on, whether we need to have the hierarchical arrangements of the clusters. So it means that we want to see, like, you know, how samples are located, and, you know, we want to see what is the hierarchical relationship between the data samples. How many clusters? Like, if we start, you know, hierarchical clustering, then at this point we'll have just one cluster. At this level we'll have three clusters. So it's very important to define. And for example, for partitioning clustering, we need to define, so it's a must-have configuration component that we need to put forward. Another thing, can we put some semantic? Like, can we understand what is the cluster and what are the groups about? Like, for example, if we have a bunch of computer viruses, we apply clustering. And then, you know, the clustering method finds five classes. Can we say that this is a worm? And for example, this is a Trojan. So are there any kind of indications that there are some semantic within the group? And if we can use the clustering methods on the big data problems. Like, for example, the traditional application of, you know, k-means, either k-means or hierarchical clustering, will face a lot of challenges when it comes to big data. They're good at small data, like tens of thousands of samples. If you're talking about tens of millions of data samples, building, you know, such dendrogram will be a challenge, because it will be a huge thing. So hierarchical clustering is the tree-based taxonomy. Like, for example, in this case, you can see that animal, vertebrate, fish, reptile, amphibia, mammal, and so on. So technically, it's the representation of the hierarchical relationship in the data set. Sometimes it's needed. So for some application, you will need to show like what is the a particular tree, for example. Like from the information security, you have ransomware. It's a general type, and then as a part of ransomware group or the type, you'll have, you know, WannaCry, Petya, and so on. So it's a real world example. Again, like there've been attempts to put a huge classification of the documents, like for example on Yahoo or Wikipedia, they put materials, let's say published materials based on their clusters or based on their topics. There is also topic modeling that you can apply to extract what is the category of the particular text. So naturally, when we apply the hierarchical clustering, the ultimate goal is to find a proper number of clusters based on the similarity measure. Like, for example, here, as I mentioned, we will have just one cluster. At this level, we will have four clusters. And then we also can put, a stopping criteria that we want to have, six clusters. This is the ultimate goal. And then our model will stop at this point, saying that, okay, these are your six clusters that you've been asking for. So technically, you don't need to build, the whole dendrogram or the whole hierarchy to extract those clusters. Of course, it depends, on how many data samples you have and how many clusters you want to extract. And then it's up to you, from which part of the whole dendrogram you start. You can start from the top or you can start from the bottom. So hierarchical clustering can be viewed from the other side, so it can be visualized as a nested clusters, right? So because like we make a vertical cut, we look at the dendrogram, but we also can put it in the horizontal view and have kind of a nested cluster. So then it's easier for us to stop at some point, saying like if you want to have one cluster, second one, third, and fourth. So four clusters. If you want to have, then we stop and say that, this is our final goal. As I mentioned, it depends on the number of clusters that we desire to have in the end and the number of data samples. So that's why it's a common way to have two approaches. The first one is bottom up. Start with the nodes as individual clusters. So we start with the kind of bottom nodes, and then we kind of proceed to the top of the hierarchy, and then we can say that okay, we can stop at this point having two clusters, and it's enough. It can be also divisive. So the same example, but we start from the top. Start with the single cluster, and then we end up with the number of clusters equal to number of data samples in the data set. So normally it's all based on the similarity on the distance metric. Of course, the challenge that you may see here, what if we have, the K will be, in this case, 5, and the number of samples will be 1,000, right? So it means that the method has to perform like 900 operations, iterations, to merge all the clusters and go up to reach five clusters. So it's very unoptimal. So it means that, you know, for this, maybe we need to have a divisive clustering so that, you know, we start with the one cluster and then we reach five clusters. So going from one is much efficient than going from, 1,000. Now, divisive, let's assume we have the number of samples, again, 1,000, and we want to have 900 clusters. So again, this won't be optimal because we need to start with the one cluster and then we need to divide it like 900 times to reach the bottom. So instead, it's probably easier to use the agglomerative clustering. So that these are the considerations that you need to remember when applying either of the methods, like agglomerative clustering or divisive clustering. So just an example, you know, number of steps, like you can start from the either agglomerative starting from number of samples equal to number of clusters, and divisive starting from the number of clusters equal to one. So just either way. So you don't need always to build a whole hierarchy. You can stop at some point. I think you can also build a hierarchy dendrogram in Weka. So you can try going to, you know, the clustering tab and then check the methods that you will find there. So there are, let's say, positive sides of hierarchical clustering because it does not depend on the number of desired clusters that you want to extract. You know, it's like just say any number and then the method will stop, so it's not like critical. So as I mentioned, the problem, it depends on how many clusters you want to have in relation to data set. If it's a very few clusters, then it's better to have a divisive clustering that starts from the top. If you have a number of clusters comparable to the magnitude of the number of samples, then it's better to start from the bottom. So of course it depends on the methods. So agglomerative clustering is, as I mentioned, we start with the number of clusters equal to number of samples, and then we start aggregating. So we are looking for a similar or the points that are close to each other. So then we start aggregating and putting those together. And then we see that, you know, after second step, that, you know, C2 and C5, they're kind of very close to each other, so we can merge them and then perform the same. You know, the next step will be probably this one. Then we have C1, C3, and then C3, C4. So now, I talked about hierarchical clustering. You can find it in Weka. You can read a little bit more in Kononenko. Another way of doing the clustering is partitioning clustering. So when we partition, so we know the partitions already. So it's k-means, Gaussian mixture model, like expectation maximization. So expectation maximization, you can actually find in Weka. So both k-means, which is called simple k-means in Weka, and EM, expectation maximization, you will find in Weka. One of the peculiarities here, they have a functionality in the expectation maximization where you can kind of ask the method to find the best number of clusters. So it will use the logarithmic minimization, and it will find, you know, the best allocation of the clusters and the corresponding number of clusters. So in that way, you can kind of calculate the optimal number of clusters. Canopy clustering, and then we also have a hard or soft clustering. So soft clustering means that, you know, there will be some overlaps. So it means that one data sample can belong to two different clusters, like maybe, you know, 80% to the first cluster and 20% to the second cluster. So what is good cluster? It's often very difficult to understand. I mean, why I mentioned this, because it's very difficult to understand what is the good cluster. How we define that, you know, the data set needs to have five clusters and not 10 clusters. There are ways of doing so, like, for example, calculating the overall error across, you know, the clusters and the interclass cluster differences, and then selecting the lowest one. So we can calculate, you know, the class divergence metric, which defines, you know, how different clusters are, and how, what is the difference inside the clusters. But it depends again on the data. It depends again on the dimensionality of the data and what is the metric that we are using. So often, like the way to measure the within cluster kind of difference is to have the variance, or let's say the difference from the center to all of the points in the cluster, right? So if we have two examples here, this one is a bit bigger. So let's say, you know, the variance in this case will be, I don't know, 100. The variance in this case will be, I don't know, 50, right? So this one is considered to be better. It's not that we have a better quality of the cluster, but like with the quantity-based qualitative metric, we can say that, you know, it's more compact. That means that, you know, the data are more close to each other, so they're more similar. And, you know, we can also calculate, for example, the differences between the cluster centers. So there will be another difference, like how far they are. So if they are very close, then maybe the clusters are not that good. If they are very far, then it's kind of better. So it's very difficult to find the optimal number of clusters. There are possibilities for expectation maximization. There are possibilities for the self-organizing map. When it comes to k-means, you can calculate, for example, a minimal square error. So what I meant is here. So within cluster distance or mean square error. So there are multiple ways you can approach. But in general, if you calculate the difference, you know, within cluster distance, and then you put the number of clusters, like 0, I don't know, 100, then at some point you will probably have, you know, increase, and then it will be decreasing, or the opposite way. So it depends again on the number of data samples in the data set and the number of clusters. But then you will see, maybe, you know, the area here is good, maybe the area here is good. It depends on the data set. But this is another way of finding the optimal number of clusters in the k-means. So now, how do we calculate the distance metric? As I mentioned, the distance is the crucial part of the clustering. So it can be Euclidean distance, inner product space, Manhattan or city block distance, Halnobis, Hamming distance, and so on. So it's unlimited. It depends on the dimensionality, and it depends on the number of samples. Like, for example, Manhattan distance, you know, so Euclidean distance, it will be between A and B, the straight one. Manhattan distance, it will be, you know, the distance that is sum of those rods. So that's why it's called also a city block distance. Mahalanobis distance, it's another type of distances, which is rather, let's say, standard deviation based. It depends, you know, how far our, let's say, center of the cluster is from the a certain point, a certain data sample, and is calculated in the number of standard deviations. So it's another type of the distance that also can be applied for the purpose. Now, the partition clustering. So if you remember from the hierarchical clustering, we just start, you know, like aggregating points until we merge everything into one cluster. Case of partitioning, it's a completely different setup. We need to have, as I mentioned, first number of clusters. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So in this case, it's 5. And then we need to have five centroids. So centroids is the points that we either assign randomly or we pick them manually and put those inside the method so that it can produce the clusters easily. So, of course, you also need to put, you know, the distance measure, like what is the distance, like Euclidean, city block distance, Mahalanobis. But technically, this is how you launch the k-means. The complexity is high, so number of clusters, number of data samples or points, number of iterations until it merged, and then also the computational complexity of the distance. You know, so if it's a Mahalanobis distance, it's simpler. If it's a Euclidean distance, you remember that you need to, you know, have a difference between all of the values in all of the dimensions, then square to the power 2 combined together in the square root taking. So there is much complexity in the difference calculation, but it can be a trade-off between the accuracy and the complexity. So that's why, you know, the big data is not good. So unfortunately, we cannot really apply the k-means for the big data. But for the big data, instead, we can use a canopy clustering. So canopy clustering is rather approximate clustering when we apply, let's say, a preliminary procedure to find, you know, these canopies that we want to use, and then, you know, assigned those as a preliminary clusters for the partitioning clustering. So it's kind of like multi-stage approach. So it's also very very applicable when it needs to be parallelized. So if you have a CPU, you know, with, I don't know, 32, 64 cores, and then you have a lot of data, and then you apply canopy clustering, that's the best outcome. So, and then also it's very important to use the cheap distance metrics. As I mentioned in this slide, that, you know, the computational complexity of the distance metric can be a culprit here. So if it's a Euclidean distance, it can take more time. If it's a city block distance, then it's simpler. So the idea in the canopy clustering is to have a, so, in a way, hierarchical approach, like to have, for example, nations, states, regions, cities, postal codes, street addresses, and so on, and then apply nearly partitioning clustering to fine-tune the regions. So how we apply the canopy clustering is, first of all, a cheaper method to find, you know, these groups using a cheap distance. So then it will be very, very quick. And then, you know, having these canopies. So the canopies, they might include a multiple elements. So it means that, you know, one element can or may appear under several canopies. And then we see, you know, whether the elements have to be included in the canopy, so they have to be excluded based on the distances. So there will be two types of distances, or the thresholds. So the thresholds T1 and T2, and then we have the initial set. So this is the algorithms how we create the canopies, or how we perform the canopy clustering. So we start with the whole set of data. Let's say we have, you know, all our data set in the S, and then we start to create the canopies, right? So the first canopy, for example, can be created with R0, let's say, and then this is our first canopy. And then for the next element, we use the chip distance, city block distance, and perform the comparison between the new element and the canopy, so the existing canopies. If the distance is smaller than T1, then the new element is placed in this canopy. If the distance is less than T2, then it's basically removed from the set. So the set S will be empty when you know, the last element has been found to be within T2. Within the last canopy center, or if it's only one element left, and then we start with the next iteration. So it's a kind of preliminary clustering. It's not like, you know, exact kind of defined, but we try to to allocate those canopies based on the two parameters, T1 and T2. So we have the cluster center, and we have two distances, T1 and T2. Like things that are outside T2, they don't belong, you know, the data samples that are outside T1, they don't belong to the cluster, that are within the T2, they cannot be a cluster center, so we don't change the cluster center. And things that, or data samples that are between T2 and T1, they also can be, let's say, cluster itself, but they're a member of this canopy of this cluster. Right, so we start with the, you know, with this particular data point that is center of the cluster, and then every point that are within T2 distance from the center of the cluster are not cluster centers, so they cannot be. And then we start, you know, evaluating data points that are between T2 and T1, so they're a member of our cluster, but they also can be cluster itself. Of course, they will be overlapped, so that's why I mentioned that, you know, it can be a soft clustering, it can be hard clustering. So they will be overlapped where we need to, you know, to decide whether we want to take data points that can be within several clusters, or they have to be within only single cluster. So the idea is to have, you know, the approximation, the first inexpensive procedure using the chip distances and using the chip approximations, and then we apply more expensive and accurate similarity measure, like, for example, Euclidean distance measure. And this is how it's done in big data. We start with the chip canopy clustering. Once we have preliminary clusters, we apply the partition clustering, like a k-means clustering. They can be, of course, a hybrid clustering, so it can be a hybrid intelligent approach where we, you know, try to also have the dimensionality reductions. Then we try to have the preliminary partitions. So we have two choices, either put them randomly or have some kind of semantics. So it can be manually picked or using the canopy clustering. So randomly, it's one of the ways to start the partition clustering. And then we adjust the clusters and apply the k-means as partitioning clustering. Now, the Gaussian mixture model, probably all of you remember what is the Gaussian model. So just a model that represents a normal distribution, right? It can be used in the clustering in a way that if the data are too complex, then we can have, you know, several distributions that are overlapping in the data set. So, like, for example, like here you have the blue or the yellow and blue, and then the points, you know, can describe, for example, more sparse yellow distribution and then a more dense blue distribution. So there will be two different distinct distributions, so two clusters, and of course there will be some overlapping. So the way to apply, there will be parameters estimation. So as you know, the Gaussian models, this is rather parametric or, let's say, ideal distributions based on the parameter that we extract from the actual data set. And then we calculate all the, let's say, all the parameters that are needed for the final model. So the difference will be that, you know, we have the true distribution from the data itself, but when we calculate, you know, the actual parameters and build the ideal models, there will be a certain error, a certain kind of approximation when it comes to a true distribution, right? So you can try to tweak the parameters in the expectation maximization method in VECA and see how it works. So, but technically, the idea is that you have one model that describes the whole clustering process based on the Gaussian distribution. So of course, the assumption here is that data are distributed using, you know, the Gaussian model. So if you want to check a few links, please do so. I can suggest that we take maybe 7 minutes break and then start again at 11:05. Test. Right, welcome back. So we're going to talk now about several things, including the support vector machines. Self-organizing map. So SOM, self-organizing map, been invented in Finland, and it's considered one of the most powerful clustering slash visualization slash grouping. It's because the way how samples are clustered, it's not exactly the normal clustering, so it's rather grouping, because the method places data samples forcibly in the in the abstraction level together. So it's not that you're working on this data plane that is given to you, but the method kind of like reshuffles the data. Normally when we have a need to apply clustering, we can see that we don't know anything about the data. We want to find some kind of structures, we want to find some kind of relationship in the data, and we want to reveal this structure that can be used for some other purpose. Like, for example, once the clustering is complete, you want to have maybe supervised learning, because you already know the groups or the labels. So it can be multiple stage approach. There are multiple issues with the data, because sometimes we have this mixture of the data that I previously shown in the Gaussian mixture models, where one data can belong to another cluster by mistake or by nature of the data. So it can be that we need to place the same data sample into multiple clusters. So there are ways to work with the clustering. Like, it can be analytical model. So we create a perfect Gaussian mixture model based on the standard deviation and mean that we calculate from the data set. It can be empirical methods, where we kind of try to extract some kind of model or anything that is in the data set to be able to approximate this structure. So unsupervised learning, that is naturally the part of the clustering. And of course, there can be different clustering ways of doing clustering. So there can be more trivial approach, like a canopy clustering, where we just place samples into different groups, and which is rather better than just random sampling, right? And then self-organizing maps, or self-organizing feature maps, as they called. So it's a very complex method. It's very much like neural network, but there is also an abstraction level that helps to create groups of samples. So analytical method is, let's say, the best scenario where we can extract the function, a simple function that defines our data. Gaussian model, so it's the best scenario. Unfortunately, in real life, especially in the big data, it's not always possible. It's way more complex. They don't follow the Gaussian distribution. Like, for example, we can have the data that are kind of like ellipsoid, the technically Gaussian distribution. We can also have the data that are something like this, right? So we can't really describe it with the Gaussian distribution, unfortunately. So it's rather random or nonlinear distribution. And we don't know exactly what this process describes in this particular case. Instead, we want to apply the empirical model, which is, the empirical set of methods that are only based on the data. So everything, all the decision, all the approximation is based on the data itself. So we don't employ this kind of ideal function describing our data set. So as you know, the difference that supervised learning, we give the machine at points where we learn, you know, that, for example, this is red, this is yellow, and which is the opposite to unsupervised learning, where we need to have, you know, kind of a different approach of asking the machine, please show which are the yellow, which are the red samples. So they can be used together. So like, for example, a supervised learning approach first and then unsupervised, or vice versa, like, for example, unsupervised and then supervised, like a neurofuzzy method that we discussed before. Unsupervised learning considered to be, let's say, it's rather a black box approach that helps to solve multiple issues that are inherent in the classification or in the supervised learning. Like, for example, cost of labeling. If you have millions of samples that we need to label manually, this is not good, right? So instead, we want to have more intelligent approach to have a separate labeling. Data mining, if we want to extract some kind of, you know, data or some kind of knowledge from the data set. Dynamic classes, so it means that, you know, sometimes, you know, they can be overlapped between the classes, or the one sample can belong to multiple classes at the same time. We also want to identify the useful features, because, you know, the same way as in classification, the same approach is valid for unsupervised learning, because some of the features may have bigger influence on having, you know, samples into different clusters. It means that, you know, if you look at the clustering from 2D perspective, you know, just bubbles that you want to create. But clustering is multidimensional approach. So the same way, you know, they can be redundant features, they can be constant features, they can be features that are less relevant. And initial exploratory data analysis. So this is in case of big data, we need to have a certain approach that precedes the you know, the normal clustering, like, for example, k-means. So we talked about k-means, we talked about Gaussian mixture model, and now the self-organization. So self-organization is also kind of grouping where we try to play. So like in this case, in case of clustering, you have multiple samples, and then you try to create this bubbles or clusters. In case of self-organization, we have, let's say, bubbles already predefined, and then, you know, out of all samples, we try to put them into different bubbles. So we try to give them flexibility to, you know, to have a self-organization based on the based on the distance measure and based on their similarity. At the same time, we want to preserve the topology, right? Because in this case, the topology is there. We don't change, you know, the features. In case of self-organization, we want to preserve the topology. We have some kind of way to demonstrate that, you know, that things that have been together in the data set, they're still together in this self-organized structure. You know, they kind of in the same stack. One of the way to look at the topology, so the self-organization, is just imagine the mountains, right? So the mountains is the three D kind of objects you have. You know, the altitude, you have the, you know, longitude, latitude, and then you try to visualize in your mind how the mountain look like. And it's the same in the real world data. We have sometimes three dimensions, sometimes we have even more dimensions, right? But we cannot visualize more than, you know, four or five dimensions in the mind, in that sense, because it will be very difficult to have, you know, this kind of like representation. So instead, we can move to contours, like a contour map. If you use Google Maps or just use the normal maps, you will see, you know, the contours that, based on the colors, the contour lines defined how deep the sea is or how high the mountains is. So normally it's the 3D move to 2D, right? It's a topology preserving modification or kind of feature reduction. And it's just one of the examples, right? Because here we transfer this one dimension, like 3D dimension, we transfer to two dimensions. So it means that one dimension we just indicate it on this map by means of, you know, additional information like the contour lines, the altitude, and also the colors. So there will be different colors when it comes to mountains. So the map of the Europe, you can see some mountains, you can see some shallow regions, like in Norway, it's a lot of mountains that, you know, we don't have the 3D representation, but still we see this information from the picture. So the same approach is used in the self-organizing map. We just want to have the projection of this multidimensional. So it's not just 3D dimension, but it can be, you know, 50 dimension, 100 dimension that we put together. And we want to maintain this 2D map. So independently from the number of dimensions, we want to maintain the 2D map that self-organizing or the SOM produces. It's not just that, but also, you know, that the data are quite heterogeneous. We can have the units, we can have the miles, we can have the meters, seconds. So it's a distance. We can have, you know, monetary value like dollars, crowns. We can have volumetric data, surface area, mass, and so on. So it means that the data is so diverse that we cannot really, you know, build a model that fits only one type of data or one semantic of the data. So instead, we need to be able to handle multiple data, but at the same time produce two-dimensional data set. And also another challenge that we discussed briefly before is data standardization, right? So the ranges of the data, like for example, you know, here the range can be from 20 to 65. Here the range can be like it's 100,000 crowns. So the ranges or the magnitude of the data will be different. Sometimes it's tens of units, sometimes it's millions of units. So there are multiple challenges when we consider creating the method that can handle, you know, such complex heterogeneous data with different units and scales. So of course, when we look back at the PCA, so if you remember, the PCA helps to remove, to reduce the data from, let's say, 10 dimensions to two or three dimensions. So it's exactly the same way, and it's lossy compression technically, because in case of PCA, if we discard part of the, you know, of the metadata, then we cannot recreate back to the normal data set. And the same in the SOM self-organizing map, we cannot really recreate the data if we don't have any meta information stored. So the topology preserving projections, like we have two classes, so class one and class two, our bubbles or ellipsoids, because they kind of Gaussian distribution. So we can use the, you know, PCA right there, but then probably the outcome or the results of the PCA won't be good. So instead, we need to find the principal components with the highest variance that is possible, or the highest eigenvector. And then it's a different type, of course, of the method. It's LDA, linear discriminant analysis. But technically, the idea is to have this kind of separate notion of classes, right? So in this case, it's very easy to apply PCA for classification, since you have two classes. For self-organizing map, there can be multiple classes. So we can define, you know, that one cluster is one class, but then maybe another cluster will be, you know, same or other class. So there can be flexibility in providing the decision when it comes to clustering. So it's in a way similar to k-means and the Gaussian mixture model, except that, as I mentioned, we have the topology modification kind of, or That is a requirement to have the preservation of the topology, because we place, so you can consider a self-organizing map as basically different buckets that we want to place things that are grouped together. So as I mentioned, the self-organizing map is the method that is very similar to neural network. So technically it's a type of neural network because it uses the same approach. It uses it uses the same training model using gradient descent. And then the only difference, let's say, from hierarchical clustering and a similarity to k-means is usage of the partition. So we need to define number of k. So when it comes to k-means clustering, we have the k. When it comes to some, we need to define two parameters, width and the height of the of the map. So we can also, of course, say that, you know, it's we define k, which is w multiplied by h. So it's multiple ways you can define. Also, there are models that can help to find the optimal optimal size of this self-organizing map. And then it's the neurons. So the map that is created by self-organizing map in the end is technically a set of neurons. Like if you have a simple neural network, you have only like one or two or three output neurons. Here you have k output neurons organized into the map. So our goal is to reduce the high-dimensional data, first of all, to create clusters, to create groups of samples, and the second goal is to have a two-dimensional map. Two-dimensional map that represents the same topology, represents the same data that is in the data set, and it's very good for visualization. Like you can try RapidMiner. There was a self-organizing map visualization functionality, so you can actually see how it arranges the samples. This is the representation, or a simple representation of the self-organizing map architecture. We have the input vector, so technically it's one layer network. We have the input layer. It's our high-dimensional data. We have the connected weights that we need to train, and then we have the output layers. So all those are output neurons. And the way how, like in practical, let's say, looking from the practical perspective, how you implement self-organizing map, you create a bucket, technically, a bucket. And then you put, like, for example, if there is an input vector, let's say D2, so this is the sample from the data set. Then based on the similarity to either of the buckets, you will place it inside the bucket. So after your model is trained, or self-organizing map is trained, and there are no more samples in the input data set, you will have buckets that have maybe five samples, that have one sample, that have no samples. So technically, it's a cluster. So technically, it's a cluster. So what I mean technically, because, you know, it's a group of samples that were assigned by unsupervised learning, but at the same time, they're not on the same topology level as the original data set when it comes to k-means. So instead, for the visualization, we are using the data from, you know, from these samples. So, sorry, this is the original work from Finland. They've been using self-organizing map to demonstrate the poverty or the economical state of the countries in the world. And of course, you can see that, you know, having at looking at some of the countries, it's of course it's abbreviation, but here you can see that Belgium and Sweden and Italy, they placed together on this map. But if you remember on the proper map, they're not together, right? So it's kind of, there is a distance between those countries, especially between Sweden and Italy. There is a certain distance of thousands of kilometers. And then we have other countries, I think it's Bangladesh, Nepal, China, Turkey, like for example, you know, it can be quite a big difference. And it can be, you know, they can be placed in the same region. I think it's Hong Kong, Singapore, Canada, USA, Denmark, Great Britain, Norway. So technically you will see that, you know, some of the countries they placed in the same bucket. Some of the countries they stay, you know, alone in their buckets. And there are of course like multiple nodes or buckets that are empty. But what it means that, you know, the original study had a lot of indicators. There have been a lot of components or, let's say, features describing the economical state of the country put together. And from this multidimensional data, they've been compressed into a two-dimensional data set. So it means that if the countries are placed in the same node, then they have a very similar state of economy, or they have a very similar state of, you know, those indicators. If you look at the original raw data set, of course, it's not possible to, you know, to fully represent it, because the data can be complex. As I mentioned, you know, it can be hundreds of features. While on this two-dimensional map, it's kind of representative, you know, the meaning of this data set, like whether the countries are closed or they're different. They're also marked by, you know, different colors. So the colors, it's another layer of semantic data included in this map. So as I mentioned, like even though these countries are placed together on the self-organizing map, they're not exactly, you know, neighbor countries, especially Italy and Sweden. Another conclusion that we can draw from this map is that if the countries are far away from each other, then they have very little in common. So the groups of the countries, they have very little in common. Like, for example, I think this is Ethiopia, and then, for example, Canada and USA. So they're very, very far. So it means that their economical indicators also, you know, quite different or dramatically different. Now, what if we try to take the original, you know, 2D map or some map to the geographical map? Then you will see that, you know, it's not a very very concise representation in the geographical locations. Even though we have the countries that, like US and Canada, that are very close by color extracted from the self-organizing map, we'll have countries, you know, like, for example, I think this is Mongolia and China, that even though they're neighbors, the economy is very different, which is indicated clearly by the self-organizing map. So how does the self-organizing map work? It's a competitive algorithm, very similar to a neural network. It uses a so-called best matching unit, BMU, where, you know, the input data placed into the input neurons, and then it tries to find the closest unit or node to the input neuron according to the distance. And then it places in that bucket or node, and then it updates all, you know, nodes or the weights around it. So technically, it's a competitive learning algorithm where these nodes that are kind of competing against each other to get a new data. So if the one node is considered to be closer to the data that is being inserted in the self-organizing map, then of course the node wins. So normally when we talk about the self-organizing map, we need to specify, you know, two parameters. As I mentioned, this is height and width. So normally we can say that, you know, it's something like 3 by 3. It's a general representation. So some of the nodes can have, you know, multiple samples. Some of the nodes can have no samples at all that have been placed after the training. So it's not necessarily that we'll get 9 clusters after training the self-organizing map. Now, the topologies can be also different. The topology can be rectangular or they can be hexagonal. So the only difference is how many connected nodes we have in the neighborhoods. So in case of the rectangular, you can see we have four nodes connected. In case of hexagonal, we have 6 nodes connected. Also, there are multiple parameters like the decay coefficient, where with the flow of time or the training, so the more iterations we apply, like for example, it's after 10 epochs training, we have, you know, a big area that this particular node will influence after the new sample is coming. So once we placed a new samples here, then every node around or the weights of every node around will be updated. And after like 100 iterations, this area will shrink. So it will become smaller and smaller after like 100 epochs. It will become smaller, smaller, and at some point it will be just a single node, which is the node itself. So the same approach is in the hexagonal neighborhood. So just, you know, instead of updating this kind of, you know, the circle, we update this hexagonal region that is close to the center or to the best matching unit. So this is our best matching unit. Yes, so that was the insight into the self-organizing map. It's a quite complex approach. You will find some of the implementations, I think, in Java and also C++. You can, of course, try to apply it yourself for your project, because it's not just clustering, but also visualization. So you can get some interesting results to visualize, you know, your data, for example, computer viruses or the network traffic. Yes, do you have any questions? Or anything that you like to ask about the self-organizing map? There have been a few links in the slides. You can try to check, you know, the links. And then you can try to read a little bit more on the, I think we have a nice article on the Wikipedia, how the self-organizing map works in general. Yes, any questions or anything that you'd like to ask? So if no question, then good luck with the assignments. You still have some time to finish the assignments. It's 27th of May, the deadline when you need to deliver 4 of them. It's 40% of the grade, and also the exam is 60% of the grade. So it's a digital home exam. So please check the IMT4133 webpage on the NTNU and also student web, so that you have, you know, the times, you know, the deadlines in place. If you have any questions about the assignments, you can talk to Kyle, or if you have any questions about the, you know, the theory and the material in the books, please reach out. Right, thank you for your attention. Then the lecture is over.